impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOON News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Today, I'm speaking with Street Roots Editor-in-Chief Kay Rambo about the latest edition of the paper, The Vendor Issue, Around the Network and Back Again. Welcome to the show, Kay.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on to talk with us about this new issue. So the latest issue has a lot of exciting elements. What are some of the different things that readers can expect from this edition?
Well, the most immediately recognizable one is probably color. This is a color issue, but it is, as you said, it's the vendor issue, just an annual thing we do. The theme for this year is around the network and back again. So in addition to including poetry and some Q&As with Street Roots vendors, there's also content about, and in some cases written by, vendors from other street papers within the International Network of Street Papers.
So one of the things in this issue is detailing the plans for Street Roots' new building on West Burnside and what vendors are most looking forward to in the new space. What can you tell me about the moving process and what the new building will be like? I don't think we've gotten the chance to talk about that on here yet.
Yeah, it's on West Burnside and 3rd, kind of right there around some Portland landmarks like Voodoo Donuts and Dante's. It is a four-story building, including the basement, which, if anyone listening has seen Street Roots' current office, it is a lot more space for us to operate with. It was really nice to hear what the vendors were most excited about. A lot of that had to do with the basement, which will include showers, kind of a salon/barbershop, and also laundry machines. So, three really important resources that are really difficult to secure on the streets. The ground level is going to be the vendor program. So that'll be a kind of a lounge for vendors, as well as where they'll go to buy papers, offices for vendor program staff, which, that in itself is a pretty significant expansion when compared to the current space that the vendor program operates out of. The second floor of the building will be the newsroom and offices for other Street Roots staff, which is really exciting because we haven't really had a proper newsroom. And then the roof of the building will have a classroom and kind of a little garden and seating area. And again, the classroom is really exciting, and it was definitely mentioned by some vendors because it's, Street Roots is, a lot of our work is around education, and we don't have a dedicated classroom space, so something like that, especially kind of up on the roof in a cool location that's designed for that purpose, is really exciting for a lot of folks.
Is there an aspect that you're the most excited about?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be really exciting to have a newsroom and just kind of a set place where everyone who works on the newspaper can gather to work. But I think the thing that's most exciting to me is just having a place that has room for everybody. Because, right now we are operating out of two different offices. Street Roots has expanded quite a bit in the last few years, so there just isn't currently space for everyone to work in the same place. So I'm very excited to have that opportunity, and certainly to be, more accessible to vendors and other non-newspaper staff members.
So another part of this vendor issue is work from the International Network of Street Papers, which includes more than 100 newspapers around the world. It might be the first time that we have explored kind of this whole network. What can you tell us about it?
Yeah, you gave a pretty good description of it. It is a kind of international NGO that creates opportunities for collaboration and support amongst street papers, all of which have, some similarities to Street Roots' model. Some are maybe a little less journalism focused, or maybe they're more focused on something like entertainment. But, kind of the basic idea that a newspaper or magazine is produced that then gives people experiencing poverty or homelessness a low barrier opportunity for employment. That is the through line through all of them. So the content that we have from other street papers are really focused on vendors at other street papers, you know, just kind of keeping in line with the vendor issue theme.
Yeah, I definitely have recognized street papers from, or that are in other cities. Like I've seen them before, but I didn't know that it was international. That's so cool.
Yeah. It's a really expansive network.
So this issue, like you mentioned, features articles about vendors from different street papers around the world. What is the role that the network aims to play in the lives of vendors?
Yeah, it's really, I think like an even bigger picture view of, you know, what Street Roots' goal is, right? To create these low barrier employment opportunities. And INSP certainly is there to help stabilize street papers so there is something that vendors consistently have to sell. They operate a news service, and we certainly have pulled wire pieces from other street papers. So, you know, it's really to kind of provide support for street papers in areas where they don't necessarily have it, and at least kind of create an opportunity for different street papers to share, you know, strategies or challenges that they may be facing in hopes of finding solutions.
Are there other upcoming events to look out for from Street Roots?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, as always, the weekly paper, but the Street Roots breakfast broadcast is coming up, which is, you know, a big community event every year. That's October 5th. And actually the back page of the paper this week gives you all the info you need to know about it. But it's, you know, a really great event every year where the community can kind of get a look inside Street Roots, get to know certain staff and vendors better. And is traditionally a really good fundraising opportunity for us, which, you know, kind of the type of expansion that we're experiencing right now and the increased need for places like Street Roots, you know, fundraising is obviously important at the moment.
If listeners are interested in picking up the paper for themselves, what's the best way for them to do that?
Go find a vendor. They will be in most places that there's a lot of foot traffic. Grocery stores, farmers markets, museums, stuff like that. If you aren't sure where to find a vendor, you can also go to the Street Roots website, and under the vendor tab, there's a very handy list of common vendor posts where you may be able to find somebody.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
I think, as always, go grab the paper. This one especially, a lot of this content is going to be print only, so if you don't buy the paper, you won't get to see it. Rather than, you know, our news content that is both print and digital. And it is a very pretty color issue, with some cool art, and I think a great opportunity to get to know vendors a little better and get to know Street Roots a little better. So go get it.
I shouldn't be surprised that you mentioned the color, but I was surprised that you didn't mention the vendor poetry.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, there's two pages of it, and it is always so popular. So I think that's also a good selling point. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you for taking the time to talk with us about this exciting issue.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Have a good day.
That was Kay Rambo, the editor-in-chief at Street Roots, speaking with me about the latest edition of the paper, The Vendor Issue, Around the Network and Back Again. More information online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings. Thank you.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. Japan and the Tokyo Electric Power Company, also known as TEPCO, recently started dumping some 350 million gallons of radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean. The dumping is expected to go on for decades. Neighboring countries are not at all happy about it, and they're not the only ones. Cindy Folkers is the radiation and health hazard specialist at Beyond Nuclear. She spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg.
Japan has started to release this radioactive water, and according to the Japanese government and TEPCO, this is perfectly safe, and they have scientists to back them up. And they seem to be suggesting there's a scientific consensus that this is okay to do because the ocean is so vast and the radioactivity will dissipate. And how do you respond to that?
So, and this isn't just me saying this, actually. There are a number of marine experts who signed a letter opposing the release of this water. So let me back up for 1 second and just let everybody remember where this water came from to begin with. In 2011, a triple meltdown of the Fukushima nuclear reactor in Japan. That means that the cores melted, and in order to cool the cores, they had to pump in water so that the cores wouldn't melt any further and so that they could cool them down and get the situation under control. And under control, I'm using that term quite loosely. What happened was the water that they used became radioactive from the melted cores, and they had to take that water and put it in containers so that it wouldn't go out directly into the environment. So that water, that wastewater that's in those containers is contaminated. It hit the melted reactor cores directly, and it's contaminated now with a whole bunch of radioisotopes. Now, they've tried to use technology to filter out some of the radioactivity. They did manage to filter out some part of some of the radionuclides, but the concern is that the ones that they managed to filter out didn't necessarily completely succeed. So there are still some radioactive isotopes such as cobalt, radioactive strontium and cesium and plutonium and the like that still exist in the water. And part of the problem is that they only have tested or analyzed about 40% of the containers, and there's like 1,000 containers, and by the time this will be all done, about 350 million gallons of radioactive water will have been dumped into the Pacific Ocean. And at this point, they only know really have a little bit of an idea what's in 40% of the containers. And what they don't know is they didn't test for every single nuclide in all of those containers. And part of the problem, too, is that there's radioactive tritium, which is basically radioactive hydrogen, that's contaminating this water, and they can't filter that out at all.
So why would any scientist suggest that this is safe, that it's safe to dump this water?
Well, when you're dealing with science, you know, you've got your independent scientists, such as those that signed this letter opposing the dumping. That includes folks from Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. And you have the scientists that are primarily nuclear engineers in the International Atomic Energy Agency and places such as that, who are nuclear power proponents. And so, of course, this was a horrible catastrophe that happened. It's still contaminating the ocean there, right off the coast of where the reactors melted down. And it really, as a reason to move forward with nuclear technology, it really would behoove people who promote nuclear technology to have this whole thing sort of forgotten or swept under the carpet, or say there's no, it wasn't a big deal. Look, it's just 10 years, 11 years after, and everything is doing fine. But that's simply not the case. And so out of sight, out of mind, and they have 1,000 or so of these tanks filled with this radioactive water, contaminated water, and if they dump it, they won't have that visual anymore. So I think that's part of it, is, you know, they want to say that nuclear power is going to be helpful for climate change, which it's not. It's going to be a huge time, energy, money, and resource suck. And it will keep us from doing the things that are actually going to benefit the climate, which is renewables, wind and solar, and the like.
And this dumping is going to take years, is that right? It's not going to be done anytime soon.
They say it's going to take about 30 to 40 years to dump all of the 350 million gallons or so of water into the Pacific Ocean. But, you know, they can spread it out all over time all they want. But the fact is that in this instance, dilution is not the solution, because a number of these isotopes, the ones that I listed before, the cobalt, the plutonium, the strontium, the cesium, they will collect in the sediments of the ocean floor along the coastline and recontaminate or contaminate and then recontaminate the ocean life that's there. And that includes tritium. Tritium, although some people will say that it can be released and it can be diluted, that's not really the case. Once it becomes organically bound, and it does that through plants primarily, it will be able to be accumulated in any sort of ocean life. So the bioconcentration will happen. And we know that it does because we just found, or TEPCO just released information on a fish that was 180 times. This was a rockfish, individual fish that was 180 times greater than the level of consumption of cesium-137 that's allowed in Japan. So that fish contamination tells us two things. The first thing that it indicates is that indeed cesium does concentrate and bioaccumulate in sea life, but it also raises the question about what kind of contamination is happening that they don't have control of. So right now you've got these 1,000 or so tanks that have what we know is radioactively contaminated water, even though they tried to filter it out, and that is contained on site. What we don't know is the contamination that's still coming from the site itself, from the land that was contaminated, or even from the cores, the melted cores, that would be recontaminating the environment. And so the fish, it's an important sign that something in the environment isn't correct, that something is recontaminating.
The neighboring countries are very concerned about this. Could you talk about that? China, Vietnam, Korea, et cetera.
Sure. And it's interesting. I mean, this is a global issue. China, I believe, has banned at least all seafood imports at this point from Japan because they don't like the release of water. At the same time, or about the same time, for instance, that the European Union has decided that they're going to allow greater imports from Japan, the United States as well. And so we see sort of a push-pull going on, as if to say, you know, for the European Union and the United States, yes, okay, go ahead and dump it in the Pacific. We trust you, Japan and TEPCO. Whereas you have countries that are closer that don't like what's going on and are not going to support Japanese imports. However, you know, you've got civil society in Korea. Korea finally decided that they would accept the dumping of the water, but the civil society in Korea has another opinion, and they are at this point having a number of protests and taking a number of actions still to this day to stop the dumping of the water. I mean, the fact remains that we really don't know what's in that wastewater, the radioactive contamination, the levels for 60% or so of the what's in those canisters right now. So to say that this has been handled in a scientific, independent, transparent way is really to give a lot more credit than is due. It's a horrible situation. And when you look at what's going on, the trust has basically been broken between civil societies and certain scientists and certain governments. They just don't trust this particular undertaking.
And so the water, the radioactivity in the water could reach the United States and Canada, would you say, and possibly South America?
Well, so we know that the radioactivity, when the catastrophe at Fukushima was first happening, did reach the United States. Uh-huh. And that was through wind and suspension of materials and rain. So that was more of an air question. What's going out into the Pacific now could very well, at least initially, stay along the coastline there and contaminate a number of places through the waves and the water and the sediment that's near the shoreline at that point, right where it's released and as the water takes it through currents along that coastline. Now, that's not to say that eventually it may not make it to other coastlines across the Pacific. The fact of the matter is, you know, we're talking decades of dumping, and we're talking decades on top of that where these radionuclides could potentially travel. And so you have really two ways to recontaminate or to contaminate areas. You've got what comes from the air and the wind and the rain and the weather, and then you've got how the water moves, right? And how the water moves can be a bit more tricky and can take a little bit longer. So I don't know how to answer that question, because the kind of contamination that's happening now, if it shows up on other coastlines further away, like South America, like United States, it could take decades.
Could you see an international boycott of Japanese fishing, even if the EU and the United States accept Japanese imports?
Well, that's a geopolitical question. And I don't know. I mean, that would have to happen at the international level. And a lot of things that happen at the international level happen at government level to begin with. And so that would be a UN question. Now, the question for the UN, though, and there was a wonderful letter that's very detailed written on the human rights violations of this dumping. And so when you're talking about an international boycott, really what we need to focus on at that level is how this is an international human rights violation. And so the letter that was written by, that was signed by civil society groups and written by a legal ocean group, basically looks at what's going on and how what's happening in Japan and the dumping, the cavalier dumping of this radioactive wastewater violates human rights, and it violates indigenous rights. It violates, they're contending in this letter, and Beyond Nuclear signed this letter, so we agree with what they say. It violates indigenous rights. It violates the rights of the child, because children are more susceptible to radioactivity than adults. It violates the right to human health. It violates the right to the environment to be healthy, and that is sort of separate and rides on top of the human rights issue, because the environment of the water and the air and all of the species that are in the environment that are not human have value of their own existence on their own, irrespective of the humans that exist in the environment. And so this letter goes into detail about that. And it's really quite comprehensive in both the scientific, the current, the state of the science, and also how what Japan is doing, they contend violates human rights.
Is Japan presenting this issue as if they have no choice, that that's the only reasonable thing they could do is to dump the water as opposed to storing it?
That's how they would present it. But the fact of the matter is that there were other ways. There are other ways to handle this. There's one way that talks about putting it in cement and sort of trapping it in that way. And so there are other ways to potentially handle this. And, you know, no way is necessarily perfect, which gets us back to, but Japan, you know, no way is necessarily perfect. But what Japan is doing is really sort of one of the most cavalier, most arrogant, sloppiest things that could possibly happen, is dumping in the Pacific Ocean, right? Radioactive waste, basically, into the Pacific Ocean. And what this speaks to is just the cavalier arrogance that the nuclear industry sort of operates with at this point. So see, Japan, while they're dumping this wastewater that's contaminated with tritium and other radionuclides, there are a number, while they're doing this, there are a number of sites in the U.S. that are also wanting to get rid of their tritium. And there are a number of places that are trying to do this, and some of them are releasing it surreptitiously and not telling the public, like at Monticello in Minnesota, not telling the public until well after they've released it. Some of them are saying that they're not releasing it, and then, you know, are on the verge of being told that they can't release it to water. So we now have a whistleblower saying at one of these decommissioning nuclear sites that they're actually trying to release it to air, that they're suspicious that they're releasing it to air surreptitiously. And so the industry just seems to be completely rogue, to do whatever they want to, no matter what civil society says, no matter what local people say, no matter even apparently what departments of environment or anyone else says who would draft any sort of a statement to prohibit this. So this cavalier attitude that we're seeing in Japan, because there are alternatives, is widespread. It's worldwide among the nuclear industry. And if we think that it's going to get any better when they build new reactors, it's not. I mean, some of these new reactors are asking that their designs not have any evacuation plants for the people around the reactors. So that means that, you know, you're not going to be told to evacuate if something were to go wrong. So they just continue to not seem to care about the people who are the neighbors of the facility, the fishers in Japan, anyone who has anything to say or should have a right to say something about what, how this industry operates is basically being ignored, ultimately.
Yeah, you'd think that this would be one of the most tightly regulated industries because of the potential danger, but you're saying not so.
No, and if anything, I think that what we're seeing them try and do is make it worse, to try and get away with even more releases. And, you know, we have studies that show that particularly in for exposure during pregnancy, that children later present with childhood cancers, including leukemia and central nervous system cancers, when they're around these facilities. So, you know, we have evidence that these facilities are bad for human health, particularly proper pregnancy development and healthy pregnancies and children that are exposed in utero.
Anything else you want to add?
I think I would say that, you know, kind of here we are again. I mean, you know, the tritium that's being dumped into the ocean at Japan was the result, and all of the other isotopes that I listed are as a result of a catastrophic release, but as part of normal operations, nuclear reactors do release certain materials, right? Radioactive materials, just as part of their operations. That's why we see increases of childhood leukemias and cancers around these facilities. And one of the things that has been ignored is an actual study as to if and why we are seeing these increases of disease around normally operating nuclear reactors, because it doesn't take a catastrophic release or a meltdown to have this material released. I mean, I suppose the final thing that I would say is that the level in the United States for contaminated food for cesium-137, which is one of the radionuclides in question that can bioaccumulate or bioconcentrate in aquatic life, is 12 times what the limit in Japan is for consumption. So now that the United States has opened up its imports to more food coming in from Japan, there's a real concern in this country that what food cannot be sold there at 100 becquerels per kilogram of cesium contamination can then be shipped off to the United States and sold here where we have 1,200 becquerels of cesium per kilogram. That's our limit. So it's 12 times. So who's to say that we couldn't import contaminated food from Japan? And I would just point out that, you know, there's an organization in California that's working on that issue. It's Fukushima Fallout Awareness Network. And it's important to realize that nuclear power is a global problem.
That's Cindy Folkers of Beyond Nuclear speaking with KABU contributor David Rosenberg. You've been listening to KABU News in Depth. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, this is Mark Sanford Gross, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
KBOO turns 55 this year. We're planning a birthday block party to celebrate 55 years of broadcasting community radio. On Saturday, September 23rd, from noon until 10 p.m., KBOO will transform a block near its studios into a festival area. Activities will include live music, station tours, food, beverages, vendors, and fun. This event is family-friendly and free to the public. From 1 until 2 p.m., KBOO will hold its annual meeting and elections for the board of directors. All are welcome to participate as KBOO discusses the accomplishments of 2023 and looks ahead to 2024. Join KBOO and celebrate. Saturday, September 23rd, noon until 10 p.m. on Southeast 8th Avenue between Ankeny and Ashe,